being on the offensive. And one of the best ways to take a bite out of Nintendo was to befriend those that Nintendo had bitten. In this manner, just as they had done with Sony and Tengen, Sega set out to form a cartel of enemies, headlined by alliances with the following. 1. Galoob. For nearly 2 years, Nintendo had been legally hammering Galoob, a California-based toy company, with plans to distribute a peripheral device called the Game Genie. This device, when attached to game cartridges, allowed players to enter codes that offered a multitude of perks, like unlimited health, an infinite number of lives, and even the ability to skip levels. Nintendo believed that this product ruined the integrity of their games and vigorously fought to keep the Game Genie out of stores. Kalinske and his troops, on the other hand, thought this was absurd. So instead of taking Galoob to court, they took them to dinner. And after the appeals and injunctions finally came to an end in December 1991, Sega became a full endorser of the product, giving it their official seal of approval and even throwing some marketing muscle behind the Game Genie. 2. Video Software Dealers Association, VSDA. Ever since it had sued Blockbuster Video in 1987 for renting out their video games, it was no secret that Nintendo did not like the rental companies, and that this feeling was mutual. While Nintendo believed that rentals prevented sales, Sega believed that this practice only served to whet a consumer's appetite. As a result, Sega forged a symbiotic relationship that began with Blockbuster during the pivotal 16 weeks of summer campaign, and expanded to the entire rental community, highlighted by Nilsson's speech at the 1992 VSDA show, which ended not only with wild applause, but promises from rental houses to bury Nintendo in any way possible. From big chains to tiny mom-and-pop outfits, Sega's relationship with the rental community proved to be a hidden competitive advantage, especially during an era when the rental industry flourished due to quicker releases of movies on VHS. 3. Disney. Although Nintendo liked to think of themselves as the Disney of video games, their relationship with the actual House of Mouse was less than ideal. This appeared to change in early 1992, when Disney bought the distribution rights to the movie Super Mario Brothers, but the possibility of Happily Ever After vanished as the movie's hellish production got worse and worse. Nintendo's loss was Kalinske's gain, as Sega was able to obtain the video game licensing rights to the 1992 hit Aladdin, as well as a collaboration deal with Disney's animation studios. This would mark the first time that Disney's hallowed animators would create a video game, providing even more evidence that Hollywood and Silicon Valley were overlapping with Sega at the center. While palling around with Nintendo's foes provided an immediate short-term benefit, Kalinske also initiated a series of long-term strategies designed to position Sega as a cutting-edge entertainment company, and Nintendo is nothing more than just a video game company. In some cases, these plans were about identifying Nintendo's weaknesses and planting a flag where their competitor had not yet broken ground, while in other cases, it was simply a matter of taking something that Nintendo already did well and doing it better. Regardless of the motivation, the goal was always to continually provide a next-level experience, accomplished by some of the following. 1. Animation. Nintendo had a hit animated series, so Sega wanted to have two. One for Saturday mornings and another for daily syndication. Pulling this off would take a miracle, so Toyota recruited Michaeline Christini, an outspoken, strong-willed miracle maker with a background in producing cartoons, Marvel, and negotiating multi-million dollar licensing deals, Mattel. Under her leadership, Sega set out to launch a pair of Sonic-based cartoons in 1993, one that aired Saturday mornings on ABC, Sonic the Hedgehog, and another that aired every day of the week after school, The Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog. Both shows would feature the vocal talents of Jaleel White, who starred as Urkel on the hit sitcom Family Matters. 2. Video games on demand. Once upon a time, Nintendo had tried and failed to turn the NES into an internet service provider. Dial-up connections were too slow, and the idea of working with the Minnesota Lottery to bring digital gambling into living rooms hit too close to home. Sega, however, believed that there was something to this idea. Instead of using phone lines, however, they wanted to use cable lines and create something called the Sega Channel, where Genesis owners could play dozens of video games on demand. Although the concept felt slightly ahead of its time, Doug Glenn believed that it could be done, and he proved it by leading Sega into serious discussions with Time Warner and TCI, who thought this could launch by late 1993. 3. Production. With the increasing convergence of movies and video games, Kalinske pushed for Sega to build a multimedia studio in Redwood City. This state-of-the-art production facility, fully operational by late 1992, provided a one-stop shop to film movie-quality video, record studio-quality audio, and render jaw-dropping special effects, all in order to produce original content for the Sega CD's lifelike video games. Ultimately, the goal would be to slowly grow this division to the point of one day producing theatrical films and releasing complete music albums, ideally to coincide with related game releases. 4. Virtual reality. Since 1991, Sega had been quietly developing a sci-fi-like set of virtual reality goggles in order to provide the most immersive gaming experience imaginable. Nicknamed the Sega VR, this futuristic visor consisted of dual LCD screens, which merged together three separate 3D technologies, and a series of tiny inertial sensors that tracked movements of the user's head. Completion of this project and proper safety testing were still more than a year away. 5. Edutainment. When it came to fun and entertaining video games, Kalinske was willing to concede the youngest demographic to Nintendo, but he believed Nintendo had made a major blunder, both financially and sociologically, by not finding a better crossover into the realm of education. To fill this gap, Sega was developing a portable computer for kids that would combine the best elements of toys, video games, and books. Of all the company's plans for expansion, this was the one that excited Kalinske the most, and the one he thought can make the biggest difference around the world. These plans provide an incomplete snapshot of Sega's vision for the next level, but regardless of how neon the future dared to be, Kalinske knew that none of it would ever happen without video games. That was Sega's heart and soul, the undeniable essence of the company, and they couldn't lose sight of that. It was true that Sega wanted to be more than just a video game company, but to accomplish that, it was vitally important that they remain a premier video game company. If ever Sega stopped providing the best hardware and software, then it could all end in the blink of an eye. Nope, not gonna happen. Kalinske refused to ever let it come to that, which was the other reason he was in New York and why he needed to speak with Olaf Olafsson. "Well," Kalinske said, scanning the busy room, "I think it's time that I find the man from Iceland." "Good thinking," Nilsson said, still staring at the Jumbotron. "And I suppose it's time I provide a game demo or two. I think it's fair to say that New York's finest journalists may win Emmys and Pulitzers, but they sure can't play video games." With that, they went their separate ways. Nilsson to tutor the mainstream press on how to reach the next level of a video game, and Kalinske through the crowd to find the president of Sony Electronic Publishing. On his way through the circuitry of smiling faces, Kalinske was targeted by Brenda Lynch and Ellen Beth Van Buskirk.
"There you are," Lynch said.
"There's someone from the Times we want you to meet," Van Buskirk said.
"Great," Kalinske said. "Can I wait a few minutes?"
"Of course," Van Buskirk said. "Go do your thing."
"All the better," Lynch confirmed. "More time for us to pump him full of propaganda before he meets the Great Oz."
"Thanks, ladies," Kalinske said. He was about to walk away when Van Buskirk darted a finger toward the window, leading his eyes to the Jumbotron.
"Come on," Van Buskirk said. "Are you seriously going to tell me that this isn't going to become an issue?"
By now, Nilsson had taken over the Sega CD and was skillfully moving through Night Trap, one of the system's launch titles. Like most titles for the Sega CD, this wasn't a pixelated, sprite-based video game with standard levels, bosses, and power-ups, but rather something more akin to a choose-your-own-adventure movie. And in the case of Night Trap, that movie was a horror thriller. It told the story of five beautiful but naive college girls at a slumber party, whose night of fun is ruined when vampiric augurs invade their secluded lake house.
With outrageously absurd monsters and damsels in distress, Night Trap featured all the tropes of a cheesy horror movie. But now, for the very first time, when moviegoers would say things like, "No, don't open the door!" the Sega CD provided the power to actually make that happen. It really was like being granted omnipotence while watching a horror film. But like most horror films, it included violence, sexual innuendo, and several gratuitous deaths, although the gore was never shown. These were the aspects that Van Buskirk meant would become an issue. This was the slaughtered elephant in the room. "There's going to be a backlash," Van Buskirk said. "I just can't see a world where that's not the case."
"I don't know," Lynch said. "It's not that bad. It's so goofy."
"Besides, we're shooting for an older demographic," Kolinsky added. "This is no worse than any PG-13 movie in theaters these days. It's what the kids like."
"Who are you trying to convince?" Van Buskirk asked. "Me or you?"
"Look," Kolinsky said, "I used to feel the same way. But I think your antennae might be up a little too high on this one. It's just one game, and it's not even a game we made. It's something we picked up to help out Sony. This won't be anything like the caliber of product that we'll get from our studio."
"Slippery, slippery goes that slope," Van Buskirk said, before shrugging and adding a smile. "But, like you said, I'm not the one you need to convince. I just wanted to put it out there again."
"And please, continue to do so," Kolinsky urged. "I appreciate the foresight."
"Aye, aye," Van Buskirk said. "We'll keep our noses extra close to the ground," Lynch assured him. "All right, then," Van Buskirk said before glancing at her wrist. "It's been a few minutes. Are you ready for the reporter from the Times?"
"Come on, that's not fair," Kolinsky said. "I've been with you this whole time. But don't worry, I'll be back soon. I just need to find our friend Mr. Olofsson."
"He should be over that way," Lynch said, nodding to her left. "He was looking for you a little bit ago."
"Excellent," Kolinsky said. "Any last words?"
"Nope," Van Buskirk replied. "Just remember to stay on message."
Kolinsky laughed and walked away. Moments later, he couldn't help but laugh again, this time to himself, when he passed Doug Glenn, who was staying precisely on message.
"Sega's programmers coined the term true video to mean CD software that looks and sounds like a movie, but plays like a great video game," Kolinsky overheard Glenn explaining in his professorial voice. "True video makes it easy to suspend disbelief and get drawn into the game fantasy. These new Sega games will have a powerful impact on the way we think about home entertainment."
Glenn's comments were spot on. Everything was, actually. The messaging, the marketing, even the little shrimp cocktails that were being brought around. Sega was firing on all cylinders and operating with a professionalism and playfulness that really did feel befitting of the next level. It was all going according to plan, except for a larger Sony issue that had to be figured out. As he took a second lap around the room, Kolinsky continued to smile, nod, and act like he had all the answers. But there was one question that wouldn't stop nagging at him. Where the hell was Olof? Chapter 37. The Sega-Sony-Nintendo Love Triangle. There he was, Tom Kolinsky. Such a difficult man to pin down. Social butterfly, man of the people, and king of the chameleons. It seemed that he was always vanishing in plain sight, but there he was now, alive and in the flesh.
"Tom," Olof Olofsson said, tapping his target on the shoulder, "I've been looking for you."
"Funny," Kolinsky said, "because I've been looking for you."
"Sure, sure," Olofsson said.
"Don't sure me," Kolinsky said. "I mean it. I've been around this room twice, and I'm starting to suspect that the only way I could have missed you both times would be if you had been following right behind me."
Olofsson chuckled quietly. "Your sense of humor always kills me," he said. "Every single time. But enough of that for now. Fate has brought us together, and we have important matters that must be discussed."
The two of them casually gravitated toward an empty corner of the room. They'd spoken a bit earlier, while doing that whole smile for the cameras thing, but this would be their first chance to actually speak with candor. "What's on your mind?" Olufsen asked.
"Probably the same thing that's on yours," Kalinske said, with a hint of frustration. "Newspaper articles hailing the wonderful relationship between Sony and Nintendo."
"It's complicated," Olufsen said, with the same level of annoyance. After Nintendo had snubbed Sony for Philips back in 1991, it was generally assumed that this signified the end of any relationship between the two Japanese powerhouses. And for a time, that was true. But 4 months later, at the Tokyo International Electronics Show in October 1991, Sony unveiled its PlayStation. Unlike the consoles that Sega and Nintendo were selling, the PlayStation aimed to deliver something more than just games. Sophisticated educational products, like Compton's Encyclopedia, Microsoft Bookshelf, and National Geographic's Mammals of the World. To those previewing the console, these impressive interactive titles proved that the PlayStation was indeed capable of more than just games. But because Sony didn't have a single game on display, this raised a question. Where were all the games? Or, even if the games weren't ready to show off, where were they going to come from? The educational titles were impressive, but they had all clearly been licensed from other companies, Compton's, Microsoft, National Geographic, etc., and without great original games, the PlayStation was just a computer in disguise. This was Sony's fundamental problem. In the land of the console, content is king, and this realization led Sony back into Nintendo's arms. With fences somewhat mended, Sony returned to the negotiating table, but quickly found Nintendo to be as stubborn as ever. The only deal that Nintendo was willing to accept would allow them to control the CD system software production with the same unforgiving authority they exerted over the cartridge business. Limited quantities, strict licensing, lockout chips. Nintendo could afford to make enemies with such policies, but Sony was just getting its feet wet and didn't want to alienate the industry. Additionally, Sony would essentially be beholden to their supposed partner in every possible way. From the creative, Nintendo could control which games were made and when, to the financial, Nintendo would collect a majority of the licensing fees. If agreed upon, this relationship wouldn't be all that different from the master-slave dynamic that Olufsen had recounted earlier. Yet, knowing all this, Sony's directors were still interested enough to consider moving forward. And the reason they felt this way had less to do with video games and more to do with videotapes. In October 1969, Sony had unveiled a prototype for the world's first video cassette recorder, VCR, which they dubbed the U-Matic. Previously, video had been captured on film reels, which presented a number of challenges like loading, playback, and duration. But the U-Matic offered an all-in-one solution to make recording easy. And most important to a company like Sony, it presented a new consumer electronics category that would empower the masses with the power of recording video. Believing that this notion of videotapes would soon take the world by storm and in turn spawn imitators, Sony approached JVC, Matsushita, and a handful of other top-tier electronic companies to sign a cross-licensing agreement and help establish unified technological standards. Although this agreement basically gave Sony's enemies a blueprint for how to build their own weapons, it ensured that Sony would at least receive a small royalty for every shot fired, and also temporarily deprived competitors of any incentive to create more powerful ammunition, as peace would be more profitable than war. Not long after that, Sony finished development of the device and launched the U-Matic in September 1971. The new device was critically praised as being the unquestioned future of recording, but that future was currently too expensive for the present. With a price tag of $1,300, the U-Matic failed to interest the consumer market, but it did quickly become the standard for television production and business communication. Although this was not the demographic that Sony initially planned to target, the business was highly lucrative, and they were more than willing to service a professional clientele until the time came when the technology became more affordable. That moment arrived in September 1974, when Sony was preparing to manufacture a more consumer-friendly videotape format dubbed Betamax, which was basically a smaller, cheaper, and easier-to-use version of the U-Matic system. Sony once again met with the top-tier electronics companies to negotiate another cross-licensing agreement, but this time, their competitors were less receptive to working together. Although JVC, Matsushita, and RCA each cited a limited recording time, only 1 hour, as their reason for resistance, a more accurate explanation might be that they did not want to become further beholden to Sony. With the U-Matic, Sony had approached its competitors with a humble, let's work together mentality. But with the Betamax, Sony had adopted more of a take-it-or-leave-it attitude, which was made clear by higher licensing fees and little interest in working together to establish unified technological standards. Sony was surprised by the industry's reluctance to adopt the new format, but assumed it was only a matter of time before this became the worldwide standard, and the Betamax was introduced to market in April 1975. Initial sales were incredibly strong, as Sony enjoyed 100% of this market it had just created. But behind the scenes, forces were at work to beat Sony at their own game. Throughout 1975, JVC's engineers worked to develop a different consumer-friendly video format, which they named the Video Home System, VHS. In September of that year, a VHS prototype was completed, and JVC quickly and quietly began to meet with other electronics companies and pitch their alternative to Sony's Betamax. The VHS resembled the Betamax in many ways, but there were two notable distinctions. The VHS recorded at a lower quality than the Betamax, which enabled longer recording times, and the VHS cost $100 less to license than the Betamax. By touting these differences and wisely reincarnating Sony's lost let's work together mentality, JVC persuaded Matsushita, Hitachi, and Mitsubishi to adopt their format, and the VHS was launched in October 1976. With strong allies, longer recording times, and a cheaper price point, the VHS quickly gave the Betamax a run for its money. Although Sony was initially caught off guard by these developments, they responded in March 1977 with the release of a new and improved Betamax videotape. This new model could record for up to 2 hours, but in Sony's effort to rush this product to market, they made the mistake of not allowing for backward compatibility. Sony's original Betamax tapes didn't work on their new VCR, which alienated most of their initial customer base. This fatal flaw, along with a series of impressive maneuvers from JVC, like well-timed price drops and savvy European expansion, set the course for a slow, painful, and very expensive death for Sony's Betamax. By 1979, Betamax held only 40% of the market. By 1984, that number had fallen to 20%, and by 1988, Sony had officially thrown in the towel and started to produce VHS VCRs. Several years had passed since the so-called videotape format war had reached a ceasefire, but Sony's scars could still be seen in every aspect of the company's play-it-safe demeanor. With video games, Sony could not afford to make the same mistake it had made with VCRs, and the best way to avoid that fate was to join forces with a powerful company whose support of a certain format could stave off extinction. And there was only one company that could provide that insurance. Nintendo. Or, more accurately, that was the case when Sony initially considered entering the video game industry, but then Sega began its ascent, and with each passing month, the Nintendo-centric worldview blurred further. Through Olufsen's persistence, Sony now acknowledged Sega's growing presence and was willing to work with them on software, but when it came to hardware, Sony still did not view Sega as a worthy suitor. Not yet, at least. Until that perception changed, Sony's board of directors had adopted something of a Nintendo or bust attitude, and once again, it was a consumer electronics show that veered them toward bust. This time there was no public embarrassment, just a lot of private hand-wringing as negotiations reached a fever point. Both Sony and Nintendo had wanted to finalize a deal prior to the 1992 summer CES. Not only was it the perfect venue for such an announcement, but there was a certain poetry to writing a happy ending at what had once been the scene of the crime. Days prior to the show, it appeared the two companies were on the brink of an agreement, getting to the point where Nintendo's PR firm Hill & Knowlton had even prepared a celebratory press release. But 11th-hour disagreements between the parties killed the deal. So, instead of marrying Sony, Nintendo renewed its vows with Philips, and the Sony-Nintendo negotiations were indefinitely put on hold. Perhaps this was due to irreconcilable differences, but more likely it was a case of cold or even frozen feet on Sony's part. Despite all the back and forth, Sony still wasn't sure if the video game industry was worth the gamble. But that all changed at the pivotal management meeting on June 24, 1992. After Sony's board of directors had made it clear that they had little interest in moving forward, Ken Kutaragi stunned them by revealing the console he had been secretly working on for months. In early 1992, he internally recruited the engineers behind Sony's System G, a special effects engine that retailed for $250,000, and persuaded them to help him build a new and improved system capable of rendering 3D graphics. By this point, he already had a basic design concept, although it was still in the architecture stage. Nevertheless, he believed it was vastly superior to anything out there, as well as to anything in Sega's and Nintendo's pipeline, and this was what he proudly presented to the executives on hand. This was the moment he had been waiting for. Unfortunately, Sony's directors still weren't fully convinced. Like before, with the Super Famicom audio chip, they fixated on the defiance and not the brilliance. Luckily for Kutaragi, also like before, Oga was there to protect him. During that meeting, he quizzed Kutaragi on the capabilities of this proposed console and how such a product would fit into the overarching Sony brand. Kutaragi adeptly answered all of Oga's questions and did so with a bravado that many in the room interpreted as arrogance. When the young engineer finished presenting his creation, Sony's chairman appeared torn. Kutaragi picked up on this and challenged his boss by asking if he was going to sit back and accept how Nintendo had treated Sony. This reminder of those fresh wounds filled Oga with rage, and looking at what could be Sony's bandage emboldened him to trust his gut. "There is no hope of making further progress with a Nintendo-compatible 16-bit machine," he said. "Let's chart our own course." Norio Oga may have been the boss, but executing this order would not be an easy thing. His voice was loud, but not always louder than the collective scream of Sony's board of directors. If they wanted to cut this project off at the knees or continue to play mix and match with Nintendo, they had enough leverage to do so. To protect Kutaragi from this type of torture and to protect Sony from potentially serious internal conflict, Oga did some corporate reshuffling. Kutaragi and 9 members of his engineering team were moved to Sony Music, which had a separate facility in Tokyo's Aoyama district. At Sony Music, Kutaragi worked under one of his mentors, Shigeo Maruyama, and had the autonomy to begin moving forward with his plans. It was still a small team, and taking this console from concept to completion was still a long shot, but at least they had a chance. And to give this project the best chance of going all the way, Kutaragi began to put together a team, which started with bringing in Phil Harrison in September 1992. Harrison knew games, having been the head of development for a software publisher named Mindscape, and his arrival marked a new level of seriousness for Sony's solo console efforts. Still, those efforts couldn't be taken too seriously. As Kutaragi spearheaded hardware development and Olufsen pushed forward with the software, Sony's board of directors continued to play tag with Nintendo. And on October 12, 1992, Sony was finally it. Exactly 3 days before Kalinske traveled to New York for the unveiling with Olufsen, there was a headline in the Seattle Times proclaiming, "Nintendo, Sony joined forces on CDs." Since the article in question didn't provide any specifics of what this supposed deal entailed, it was clearly meant to be a message from Sony's old guard that they were still a force to contend with. "It's complicated," Olufsen reiterated, shaking his head. "I realize this is not quite the response you were hoping for, but I think this actually works to our advantage." "How's that?" Kalinske asked, sincerely hoping his friend had a good answer. "Because," Olufsen said with a wispy smile, "we can tilt the variables of the equation in our direction." The equation was for a next-generation console, and the direction that both Kalinske and Olufsen had in mind entailed a joint relationship between Sega and Sony. Although the relationship between the men and their companies had perhaps begun with the intention of sticking it to Nintendo, it had evolved to something much greater than that. There was still the feeling that by working together, they could be stronger than Nintendo, but what made the relationship possible was a shared vision. Video games are no longer just video games, but rather a Trojan horse to get inside the living room and be at the forefront of the entertainment revolution. This was the level after the next level, and it was time for Sega and Sony to go there together. "This is my thinking," Olufsen explained, narrowing his eyes slightly. "This news will no doubt be greeted by those at Sony Music as it has been by both you and me. Further undue nonsense with Nintendo. But beyond the frustration, there is a significant lesson to glean. Sony is still quite open to video games, as long as they are running this race with the giants by their side." "Well," Olufsen said, his eyes popping open, "a giant is a giant is a giant. And I have a feeling that Mr. Kutaragi would be much more comfortable with someone of your stature." Kalinske considered this. "Do you really think you'd be able to work with SOJ? "Ah," Olufsen said with a smile, "you've heard of Mr. Kutaragi's reputation." "I think everyone in this room has heard of his reputation. It's true he's no picnic to work with, but it's also true that he's brilliant, and he cares deeply about his work. So I would suspect that he's smart enough to travel down the road most likely to take his work toward fruition." "Good," Kalinske said, a weight lifting off his shoulders. "That all makes sense." "For the most part," Olufsen said. "But what about on your end? There is the matter of Mr. Nakayama and his reputation."
"Gee, Olaf," Kalinske joked. "Who spilled that secret?"
Olufsen tapped the side of his head. "First-hand intelligence."
"Nakayama-san can also be a difficult man to work with," Kalinske acknowledged. "But when push comes to shove, he's always stood by my side."
"Good," Olufsen said. "Good, good."
With business out of the way, Kalinske and Olufsen discussed their families and plans for the holiday season, and then walked through the lounge together, enjoying what would be the first step in a long-term, symbiotic, and game-changing relationship.
"Will you have time to take in some sights before leaving?" Olufsen asked.
"Just one sight, unfortunately," Kalinske replied. "And it's in Long Island."
Olufsen raised an eyebrow, until he realized what could possibly be worth seeing out there.
"Please say hello to Greg for me," Olufsen requested. "And ask him to tell you about his recent visit to Germany."
"Why? What happened in Germany?" Kalinske asked.
"I'd tell you myself, but how dare I deprive you the joy of curiosity."
Chapter 38. Something Wicked This Way Comes.
"Is all that blood really necessary?" Kalinske asked, as he hovered over the arcade cabinet for a brand new fighting game. Beside him were Greg Fishback and Jim Skoropowski, the men whom he had trekked out to Long Island to see.
"It's part of the ambiance," Fishback cheerfully explained. He was a slender man with sandy blonde hair and a refined fashion sense that somehow seemed to match the perpetual smirk on his face. "Besides, the kids are gonna love it."
"Yep," added Skoropowski, a bulky fellow who is generally short on words.
"I'll bet," Kalinske reluctantly agreed, as one of the characters on screen ripped out the spine of another.
The game in question had been dreamed up by a pair of game designers named Ed Boone and John Tobias. Instead of using traditional animation, they used digitized graphics to create a fighting game they had originally hoped would star either Aikido master Steven Seagal or European star Jean-Claude Van Damme. After resistance from Seagal and Van Damme, Boone and Tobias decided to create their own characters, their own rules, and their own mythology. The result was an intricately detailed and very, very bloody story that followed complex characters fighting against each other for the chance to represent Earth in a battle against an evil monster in a cosmic tournament that would decide the fate of humanity.
They spent 10 months creating and perfecting their vision, and weaved in all sorts of special moves and hidden secrets. They called their masterpiece Mortal Kombat. It was like Street Fighter 2 on speed.
I've seen a lot of hits in my time, Fishback explained. But this one, trust me, it's the one.
Although Fishback tended to speak about any subject as if he knew it inside and out, when it came to video games, he really did. He and Skorpowski had met in 1983 when they were both working for Activision, the software company made famous by being the first third-party licensee for the Atari 2600, and then made wealthy by releasing hit games like Pitfall and River Raid. 4 years later, the two began to think about forming their own software company and following in Activision's footsteps, except in this case they sought to become the first American licensee for Nintendo. At the time of their mutual brainstorm, Nintendo's success wasn't a foregone conclusion. The NES had just enjoyed a very successful 1986 Christmas season, but there were still plenty of naysayers claiming fad and predicting imminent doom. Skepticism was in the air, and as first-hand witnesses to the crash of 83, Fishback and Skorpowski knew the hazards of such an endeavor. But they were young and optimistic enough to shrug off the risks in favor of the potential rewards. After deciding to take the plunge, the only thing left to decide upon was a name for their endeavor. Fishback said that he would be okay with anything as long as it began with an A or a Z. Skorpowski did him one better and came up with Acclaim, which would trump their alma mater Activision in the phone book. They contacted Howard Lincoln in the spring of 1987 and became the first American company to join Nintendo's third-party licensing program. Fishback and Skorpowski quickly realized that their skill set wasn't necessarily in creating games from scratch, but rather in publishing titles made by others. They were businessmen at heart, blessed with the hustle genes in their DNA, and so they set to work obtaining the rights to games that they could then publish for Nintendo. They released their first title for the NES in September 1987, an action-adventure game called Star Voyager. As per their strategy, this wasn't a groundbreaking title, but actually an updated version of a game with the same name that had been released for the Atari 2600 in 1982. They made a deal with the game's developer, ASC2 Entertainment, to release Star Voyager for the NES, and then followed it up with four more titles to fulfill their quota. Tiger Heli, originally a Japanese arcade game made by Toa Plan, 3D World Runner, developed by Square, Wizards and Warriors, developed by Rare, and Winter Games, a game made by Epix that was originally released in 1985 for the Commodore 64. Acclaim got all of these titles out by Christmas 1987, and by the first quarter of 1988, the company had made more than $1 million in profits. Sensing the opportunity of a lifetime, Fishback and Skorpowski took their young company public and received a windfall of cash, which they used to acquire other, smaller publishers and to expand their licensing endeavors. Now, instead of simply publishing content developed by others, they could purchase the rights to make games based on hit movies, television shows, and sports. This led to NES titles like Rambo 1988, Airwolf 1989, and WWF WrestleMania 1989. By 1989, Acclaim had reached $109.3 million in revenue. Fishback and Skorpowski were pleased, of course, but their hustler DNA whispered for more. They wanted to expand, to build an empire. But that was difficult to do with Nintendo's stringent licensing agreement permitting only 5 games per year. They asked Lincoln to increase their quota, but Nintendo was unwilling to set a precedent of exception. There was, however, a loophole that Nintendo was willing to allow. If Acclaim purchased another licensee, then they could double their output. Fishback and Skorpowski got the message, and in April 1990, Acclaim paid $13.75 million to acquire LJN Toys, an entertainment company known for making great toys, like Oodles and Thundercats, and lousy games, like Back to the Future and Friday the 13th. Between the two entities, they can now make 10 games per year, and in 1990, Acclaim reached $140.7 million in revenue. If the money was rolling in for Acclaim, then it had to be rolling in even faster for Nintendo, which physically manufactured the cartridges and also got a percentage of every game sold. Through mutual benefit and reciprocal affection, a deep friendship blossomed between Acclaim's Fishback and Skorpowski and Nintendo's Lincoln and Arakawa. They spoke frequently by phone about matters both personal and professional, and even though Acclaim was based in New York and Nintendo in Washington, the four of them made an effort to get together for dinner every 4 to 6 weeks, sometimes on the East Coast, sometimes on the West Coast, and sometimes in the cities they remembered from the history books they'd studied as boys. "Hey, Greg," Kalinske said, as gory highlights from Mortal Kombat continued to scroll before his eyes. "I was with Olaf the other day, and he suggested that I ask you about Germany. Any idea what that's supposed to mean?" Fishback's eyes lit up at the memory. Or maybe it was just the bloody red reflection on his face. "Right. That fateful day in Frankfurt," Fishback said, shaking his head. "No shouting from Howard, but it was still a pretty wild time." In the summer of 1991, Fishback and Skorpowski traveled to Germany for a dinner with Minoru Arakawa, his wife Yoko, and Howard Lincoln. It had been set up like all their other around-the-world dinners, but this one would be different. After years of lucrative, symbiotic work with Nintendo, Acclaim would begin publishing games for the Sega Genesis. They had no idea how Arakawa and Lincoln would respond to this news, and were not particularly eager to find out. It would have been easy to say Acclaim's decision to work with Sega was about business, not friendship, but that wouldn't be completely accurate. As close as Fishback was with Arakawa and Lincoln, he was equally close to Hayao Nakayama, and considered Sega's leader to be a good friend. They had met a few years ago on one of Fishback's increasingly frequent trips to Japan. Nakayama had known that he had no chance of luring Acclaim away from Nintendo's NES into Sega's Master System, but he asked anyway. Fishback, of course, had declined, but they did find a way to do some business together. Nintendo of America may have had a famously strict licensing agreement, but their contract applied only to America. In Japan, however, Acclaim had no exclusive relationship with Nintendo, and Nakayama was able to license games like WWF WrestleMania from Fishback's company. As their business relationship blossomed, so did their friendship. When Fishback traveled to Japan every other month, he could always count on two things: dinner with Nakayama, and that at some point during that dinner, Nakayama would make a plea for Acclaim to publish games for Sega. At first it was cute and flattering, like a naive middle school girl asking out the high school quarterback, but now that girl was all grown up and a knockout. Fishback didn't believe that anyone could effectively cut into Nintendo's market, but Sega of America was making major moves and could not be ignored. Kalinske had changed the culture over there. Sonic was speeding through stores across America, and Sega's grassroots marketing efforts were so damn aggressive that they were impossible not to admire. For these reasons, the last time Fishback had seen Nakayama and once again been asked to publish games for Sega, he'd responded that he would at least consider the idea. Acclaim was a public company, after all, and at the end of the day he answered to the shareholders. If releasing games for Nintendo and Sega would increase revenues, then that was what Acclaim ought to do. The question was whether, after Acclaim began working with Sega, Arakawa and Lincoln would continue to allow them to release games for Nintendo. If they didn't, then Acclaim would have to make a choice. And back then, those kinds of choices always ended in favor of Nintendo. Fishback and Skorpowski reached Germany in the afternoon, and after checking in, had thought about bringing all of this up at the hotel where all of them were staying. But feeling anxious, they decided to postpone the conversation until dinner, for which they had reservations at a gorgeous place about 20 miles outside the city. The five of them were unable to all fit into one cab, so Fishback and Skorpowski hopped into the first taxi, and then Mr. and Mrs. Arakawa and Howard Lincoln jumped into the next, following them to their destination. As such, Fishback and Skorpowski found themselves in the backseat of a cream-colored Mercedes taxicab, coming up with potential segues to bring up the issue at hand. In the middle of the last-minute brainstorming session, however, their cab got into a horrible accident. The Arakawas and Howard Lincoln saw it all happen before their eyes. The taxi in front of them, carrying Fishback and Skorpowski, was making a left-hand turn, but the taxi driver must not have noticed the oncoming car, which broadsided the taxi, crushing it, and sending it into a nearby ditch. The occupants of the taxi had to be dead. There was no doubt in the minds of anyone who had seen the accident. except that moments later, Fishback, Skoropowski, and the driver stumbled out of the taxi. They were dinged up with cuts and bruises, but had not suffered anything near the damage that had been done to the car, which was totaled. The folks from Nintendo hugged their friends tightly, partly out of joy, and partly to confirm that they weren't seeing ghosts. Somehow, Fishback and Skoropowski had survived. After that, the five of them crammed into one taxi and continued on to the restaurant. With top-shelf scotch in their hands, they celebrated life, friendship, and the pleasure of business, which was occasionally interrupted by Skoropowski finding small shards of glass in his hair. At some point, even without a very good way to segue into it, Fishback revealed that they would be publishing games for Sega. Lincoln and Arakawa instinctively looked to each other, and in that moment of hollow silence, Fishback braced for the blowback. "Who cares?" Lincoln shrugged. "You guys are alive. That's all that matters." Arakawa nodded sincerely. "This is much more important." The conversation then resumed with the same joy as before, all five of them partially aware that things would never be the same again. But still they drank, appreciating the incredible here and now. "That's insane," Kalinske declared when Fishback finished the story. "I wonder, do you really think the conversation would have gone differently if not for the incident?"
"I don't know," Fishback said. "But I like to believe that some awful, awful German cab driver unknowingly changed the history of video games forever."
"That's a pretty bold claim," Kalinske declared.
"Yes, but have you been paying attention to this game?" Fishback replied. "Trust me when I say that Mortal Kombat is going to change everything."
Kalinske agreed. And if Sega really stood any chance of knocking down Nintendo's door, they needed to license the game. The copious amounts of blood and violence were certainly not ideal, but Kalinske had already made peace with this issue. "I want the exclusive rights to this. What's it going to take?"
"Actually," Fishback began, "we were thinking about doing this one differently."
"Changing it up," Skoropowski added, but it didn't alleviate Kalinske's confusion.
"We're going to license the game to both you and Nintendo," Fishback explained, "to release on both systems the same day. That is, if you still want it."
The situation wasn't quite what he wanted, but as he thought about it more, it seemed almost for the best. For years, Sega and Nintendo had been going back and forth, arguing over numbers, technical specifications, and sell-in versus sell-through. Finally, though, there would be something to settle the debate once and for all. One game released on both systems at the same time on the same day. Whoever won the battle would not only get bragging rights, but likely also sew up a majority of the market share. Just like the fighters in the Mortal Kombat, one company would be left standing when it was all said and done. "Of course we still want it," Kalinske said, as the adrenaline rushed through his veins. "May the best man win, right?" Chapter 39. And away we go. On November 19th, 1992, Tom Kalinske addressed Sega of America's nearly 300 employees from the loading dock of the company's distribution warehouse in Hayward, California. There, with an unquenchable grin on his face, Kalinske delivered a passionate speech that Ellen Beth Van Buskirk had prepared for this momentous occasion. "Today we celebrate a tremendous Sega effort." The applause cut off Kalinske right away. There was just no way to repress it any longer. Plus, it looked good for the cameras. Although this event had been designed as a thank you to Sega's employees, it also cleverly doubled as a PR opportunity to officially kick Sonic Tuesday into motion. It was the video game world's equivalent of Santa loading his sleigh. "After 14 months of development, marketing, and operational achievement, we are here to commemorate the first shipment of Sonic the Hedgehog 2. This wasn't just 14 months of work, but years of effort from hundreds of employees. Some were right here in the crowd, some were across the ocean, and others had planted the seeds once upon a time, but were long gone by now. It was the ultimate team effort, and that's why everyone in attendance was wearing the same thing. A hooded sweatshirt with the words, "We did it," scrolling up the sleeve.
"We've all grown to love this feisty little hedgehog."
At the heart of everything was Sonic the Hedgehog, Sega's little engine that could, did, and was ready to do again. According to a recent national survey, Sonic was now a more recognizable American icon than Mario, MC Hammer, and even Mickey Mouse.
And with this sequel, we can be proud of the team accomplishment which has produced the very best video game of all time.
For months, Sega of America had been guarding this new game as if it were enriched uranium, which in terms of the war with Nintendo was exactly what it was. Development was kept strictly under wraps, minus the 4 screenshots each month that Nilsson would select to share with the public.
"Let me share with you what the national news media are saying about our blue-spiked friend."
But that Hollywood-esque super-secret teaser mentality changed on October 8th, with the beginning of Sega's Sonic 2 store tour. Since then, 345 retail locations and 3 Air Force bases in 16 markets gave customers an exclusive opportunity to play the game.
"To watch Sonic kick into overdrive or be hurled through a pneumatic tube at what seems like the speed of sound is really amazing," Associated Press. "What's faster than a speeding bullet, stronger than a locomotive, and able to leap tall buildings with a single bound? Well, him too, but we're talking about Sonic the Hedgehog." GamePro. "Not enough adjectives describe this game. Faster, bigger, wilder, and even more fun. Welcome back, Sonic. Missed ya."
Richmond Times-Dispatch.
"Sonic 2 is, without a doubt, going to be one of the greatest action carts for Genesis." Electronic Gaming Monthly.
During the Sonic 2 store tour, 27,386 people played the game, 54% of them kids, 36% teens, and 8% adults. An additional 24,027 people stopped by to ask questions and watch others play. At the stores, 3 of the most frequent comments were, "The new game is awesome. I want this for Christmas," and "Sega is better than Nintendo."
"Sonic has captured the hearts and minds of gamers and fans everywhere. I thank all of you for believing in Sonic and giving him better than the best you had to offer."
Once again, Kalinske was happy to be cut off by an explosion of applause. Normally, when giving speeches, it was his job to inspire the crowd. But today, that dynamic felt reversed. And the best part was Sega's success and that which would follow was about more than just Sonic. As Peter Main had pointed out years earlier, the name of the game was the game, and Sega was not only making great ones, but games that other companies wouldn't have dared to make, and they were becoming bestsellers. There was no better example than Echo the Dolphin, which had been greenlit at an Italian restaurant years earlier, and now was roping in a female audience of gamers.
"Each of you are responsible for making Sonic 2 the biggest-selling video game cartridge of all time. We are going to sell 2 million games here in the U.S. and another 2.5 million worldwide. In fact, we have already pre-sold 20% of that volume, a phenomenon never seen before in the industry."
This second sentence was staggering, but it was the first that truly told the story. Without every single one of Sega's employees acting in exactly the way that they had, Sega's grand experiment would not be where it was today. Every little action mattered. Every big idea had to be made real by the entire team.
"What makes this cart even more special is that Sonic 2 sales will contribute more than $500,000 toward the Sega Charitable Youth Education and Health Foundation. I'm real proud of that achievement, too."
And somewhere out there, so was Anik, whose unique smile was no doubt lighting up the heavens.
"I now want to recognize a few of the key people who went to the proverbial Mobius and back to create Sonic 2. Please raise your hands as I call out your name."
Sega's success was such an A to Z team effort that it felt almost cruel to single out only a handful of individuals. But it would have been crueler not to shine a momentary spotlight on those whose every action personified the next level.
"To the man with legs long enough to straddle Japan and the United States, Shinobu Toyota. To those who dared to dream up this game, Yuji Naka,
Masaharu Yoshi, Yasushi Yamaguchi, Yutaka Sugano, all the STI artists and programmers. To those who made this more than just a game, Al Nilsson, Bob Harris, Franz Tantiato, Ellen Beth Van Buskirk. To those who went door-to-door selling Sega's Revolution, Richard Burns, Len Cicerettoand the sales group. To those who turned operations into an art form. Glenn Weissman, Layla Atassi, Joe Walkington, Roger Rambeau, Sandy Tallarico and the Warehouse Bunch. To those producers, developers, and testers who could see the world in pixels. Steve Apoor, Ben Simkoviak, and our valiant testers. Thank you again for your vision and hard work. Amongst the raucous applause and the humble bows, there was one name notably missing from the list, Madeline Schroeder. In July, the mother of Sonic had left Sega, along with Jude Lang, to start their own software developer, Crystal Dynamics. This unexpected move signified an irreversible maturation for Sega, which had now earned enough clout to be viewed as a launching pad for bold career moves. This changing of the guard signaled that the company would likely experience an exit of many of those who had made Sega special, and an influx of new employees hoping to make a dent. Speaking of hard work, we have a little more left to do before Sonic makes his way to the 13,000 retailer doors nationwide. It had been 2 years since Kalinske took over, and in that time so much had changed. The Genesis was now in over 13,000 stores, up from 4,000, and Sega of America team now had nearly 300 employees, up from 50, and in 1992, the company's sales quadrupled to over $500 million. We now need to ship all this great product, and we need to ship it to arrive all on November 24th, Sonic Tuesday, to each and every retailer. There were two major events scheduled for Sonic Tuesday. One would be held at Toys R Us in New York City's Herald Square, and the other would be at the store's location in Burbank, California. Teen celebrities had been confirmed for both events. We're calling it the Great Sonic Airlift, and we've enlisted the support of Emory Worldwide to undertake this epic task. Now I'd like to ask Mr. James Schutzenhofer, the Vice President of Emory's West Coast Operations, and Mr. Al Nilsson, Sega's Group Marketing Director, the man who created and directed the awesome marketing campaign behind Sonic 2's launch, to join me up here to get out the first shipment of Sonic the Hedgehog 2 cartridges. Schutzenhofer, blushing from the attention, stumbled over to Kalinske, followed by Nilsson, who needed a second to accept that this surreal-feeling moment was actually very real. "Yes, Sonic, you and Tails can join, too." As Sonic and Tails danced up to the loading dock, Kalinske held up a sealed copy of Sonic the Hedgehog 2. It was amazing, he thought, that Sonic had been around for less than 2 years, but already felt as real as Mickey Mouse. Tails, of course, wasn't at that level yet, but he was on his way. And so would the next character, and the character after that, as long as Sega kept their eyes on the prize. It was even more amazing that his son Brandon would grow up in a world where Sonic would be as timeless as any other two-dimensional character. Even after Kalinske one day left this world, Sonic would be there, in some strange way, to watch over his children. No matter what else he did in life, there would always be Barbie and Sonic. But since Tom had no further influence over Barbie, it was all up to Sonic now. "This box commemorates the beginning of the Great Sonic Airlift. Congratulations, Sonic, and congratulations, Sega." Photographs were taken, T-shirts were given out, and congratulatory hugs took place left and right. It was a wonderful occasion that would be remembered as even more golden when, just 1 week later, the American home console market would be split evenly between Sega and Nintendo. Part 4. Civil War. Chapter 40. How the Grinch Stole Christmas. What the heck was wrong with Sega of Japan? Seriously, what was it about those guys? Was it that they compulsively marched to the beat of their own drum? Or, like a petulant child, did they just like banging on drums and then smiling at the cacophony? There was something going on there, something ominously bizarre. But Tom Kalinske couldn't put his finger on it. And right now, he didn't have the time to sleuth around and solve the mystery.